May the peace of Christ be with you. Welcome to Holy Family Radio. This is Deacon Jim Thorndale, and I'm privileged to be your host today. I warmly invite you to enter into another conversation on living the Catholic life. Living the Catholic life sometimes means we just have this understanding that we live in this Roman Catholic Church and that everything else is superfluous, that we just have this understanding that we are the one true church, which we are, but there's no other discernment, there's no other discrimination against other churches and everything else. But what we're trying to really understand today is, what is the difference between the Roman Catholic Church, maybe the Eastern Rite Catholic Church, the Orthodox Church, one in which my mother was a part of when I grew up as a young man. And, you know, I think we're confused sometimes on what the differences can be. And I thought, who better to help us understand that today than the head of the theology department at Aquinas College, Dr. Robert Markle. Doctor, welcome. Thanks for being here.
I'm glad to be here, Jim.
It's a pleasure to have you here. You know, I think I'm going through this little list of things that Catholics sometimes don't understand. I know we understand a lot about our church, but you know, there's really a difficulty in understanding the different churches, the different rites, and whether they're Orthodox or whether they're part of the Catholic Church. And I really would like to have that one of the conversations today about that. But I think, first of all, I think it's important that the audience know who's speaking to them. And if you could, just give us a little bit of a synopsis of what your journey to the doctorate you have in theology was all about, and how you ended up at Aquinas.
Oh, it's a long story. I grew up in western Pennsylvania in a steel town called Braddock.
Oh, yeah.
My father was Slovak Evangelical Lutheran, actually. Hmm. Was part of the Missouri Synod tradition. Immigrant family, and my mother was Irish Catholic, again, immigrant family.
Okay.
And they married in the Roman Catholic.
Which one did you practice Catholicism?
I was raised by my Irish mother.
Okay.
That trumps. the mother trumped. So, but in any event, I grew up in that area, went to the Catholic schools all my life, taught by the Dominican Sisters of St. Mary's of the Springs of Columbus, Ohio. And I was fortunate enough to, at that time, have a superb, I think, Catholic education. It was very formative for me. And the sisters have been I think about Benedict Grischel oftentimes says he's a sister's kid.
Oh, yeah.
And you know what? I'm a sister's kid. And they were very formative in my development.
And I, too, with the Dominican
sisters.
Yes.
And there was something about that education, Jim, yes, that I think is incredibly worthwhile. So I had the best of all worlds. Before Vatican II, I was in grade school, and I had my university education after the council.
Okay.
And again, sisters and women religious, consecrated women, had a great influence on me. I had a job at teaching religion and history at a school in Homestead, Pennsylvania, called Boyle High School.
Okay.
So I taught history there, and I taught religion there.
Okay.
And went on and did an MA in history at the time at the University of Pittsburgh, and did a master's degree in religion and religious education at Duquesne University.
Okay.
And in that journey, I was asked later, as I was teaching for the Diocese of Pittsburgh as a secondary Catholic lay teacher, mm-hmm, to pursue a doctorate.
Okay.
The Sister Mary Evelyn, who was a sister of St. Joseph of Baden, PA, asked me to do that. So it was not that I intended to do a doctorate in theology.
Right.
But eventually I did this. At that time I was married and had one child. And then within the next couple of years I finished a doctorate and had several more children.
Okay.
So I came out here in 1989. I'd finished my work at Duquesne. I was waiting to have my doctorate awarded. It would be awarded in December. I started in August, and it was going to be awarded in December because there was no summer defense of my dissertation. My dissertation at the time actually was on the 1983 Bishop Statement called The Challenge of Peace.
Okay.
In which the bishops claimed that pacifism was a complementary and equal option for individuals on the question of war and peace.
Okay.
So that was my training. My training was Catholic.
There were conscientious objectors in the wars.
There were. Actually, it's a very interesting position, yeah, because you have the American bishops and the church in general changing or developing from 56, 1956, in which Pius XII said, no Catholic can claim conscientious objector status. 1965, in Gaudium et Spes, the Universal Church, the Council Fathers, in communion with Paul VI, state in that document on the Church in the Modern World that there needs to be humane provisions for conscientious objectors.
Right.
The American bishops even went further later on during the Vietnam conflict and actually argued for what was called selective conscientious objection. So there was a real shift or development. I think one of the things that people need to know is that, you know, in certainly fundamentals there's no change, but there certainly is development.
Of course,
in Catholic teaching, obviously.
Yeah.
And I think that's important for your audience.
The church develops as everybody else does too.
Exactly.
With this understanding.
Exactly. Organically, like child
that's right.
develop.
It has
clearly
to.
The spirit is present throughout the ages in the church.
Yeah. Because the church certainly can't provide for all circumstances when they first write those, because things change, and so they have to really look at the heart of what's going on at the time when they make those decisions. And that's what they've done. So here you are. You've got your doctrine. Let me ask you this question. Just going back a little bit, were you a faithful Catholic? Were you attending Mass all the time?
I was never. I'm a cradle Catholic.
Okay.
Right? So I've never. I'm not a revert or convert.
Okay.
And I appreciate both the passion and, yeah. and concern of both reverts and converts, but it's a very different flair.
Yeah.
Exactly. Those of us who are cradle have a different perspective.
Yes.
I think we tend to be less intense.
I think we tend to be,
those of us, I don't know if you're a cradle or you're...
I'm a cradle Catholic.
You're a cradle, you're not a revert.
No. As a matter of fact, I told people I was raised in a Catholic household, but also my mother's a Greek Orthodox, which influenced me quite a bit in my growing up. So I kind of got the best of both worlds at that.
That's neat. That's very good. Did your mother finally become a Catholic?
No, because I had a grandmother who probably would have strung my dad if that would have happened.
My father never became Catholic. My grandmother is very staunch. Yeah. Very staunch Missouri Synod Lutheran. And
yeah.
It never happened. My dad didn't practice much of anything, but when he did go to church, he went to the Catholic church.
Yeah. Well, my dad was a practicing Catholic, but my mother would go with us periodically without my grandmother knowing.
Okay.
Because it would cause too much tension in the house. But that was just back then when I was growing up, that was the status between the Orthodox and the Catholics. There's a lot of there's tension now, but it was even more so back in those times.
It was a very different scene. There are some in the Orthodox world, and you alluded to the fact we may address that. There's some in the Orthodox world. So, for example, some monks on Mount Athos, a Moscow Patriarchate that tend to be more rigid.
Yes.
Others are less so, and there's been a deeper recognition of the fact that the church began as churches.
Yes.
That were all in communion with each other.
Yes. Yeah.
So you got a church in Jerusalem, the Mother Church. You have a church in Alexandria.
Yep.
You have a church in Antioch.
Absolutely.
You have a church in Rome, and you have a church in Constantinople. So
yes.
The churches are in communion with each other.
Right.
And as a Catholic, I'm happy to say that that churches that were in communion with each other also were in communion with the principal church,
yes.
The church of Peter and Paul, which was Rome.
Yes, yes.
And that's actually why I'm a Catholic. Otherwise, I could be Orthodox, quite candidly.
I understand.
I often say that. I mean, in many ways, I could be Orthodox.
Yeah, exactly.
Because of the attraction there. But
wonderful. I need to ask you one other question, because I always find this striking. Were you ever an altar boy?
No, I was a choir boy.
A choir boy.
And the reason I was a choir boy is because Sister Mary Grace, of eternal and happy memory, had the first shot. So and any of us that could sing were the altar boys are the ones that had no voice.
Yeah, that's right. They grabbed you.
The altar boys were the ones. At that time in the school I went to, St. Thomas Grade School in Braddock, she picked the choir first.
Yeah.
And then the ones that couldn't sing became altar boys.
That's right.
It's like they say in the Eastern churches oftentimes that once you use your voice as a deacon,
you're done.
You're done. Then you have to become a priest.
I do not have a great singing voice, but I was called to do at the Eastern Rite in Detroit when my cousin Paco's son was receiving his first Holy Communion, and I agreed to be the deacon of the altar. I had no idea what I was getting into.
And you have to sing. It's a whole different.
It is.
It's a whole different role for deacons.
It was.
The East has a very different role. I think we talked about this when I had you in class.
Yes.
In ecclesiology, but
yes.
There's a very different role for deacons.
Yes.
Deacons have a much more dominant liturgical role.
Yes, it does.
Although they don't do things like bless objects or persons or whatever.
Right, that's reserved for the priest.
That's reserved for the priest. So, yes. But there is otherwise, it differs.
Yes, and for those of you who are listening, Dr. Marco was one of my professors when I was going through my diaconate training, and I grew to come to know Dr. Marco quite well. Now I consider him a friend, and it's been a great relationship with him. So today we're talking about many different things. We're talking about his upbringing and how he received his doctorate. Now he's the head of theology at Aquinas College, and we're happy to have him here. One of the issues I would like to talk to you about, because right now, Doctor, there is so much confusion in Catholic minds, and particularly watching the problems with ISIS and this war going on in Iraq, and how we as Catholics have to look at this. And there is a principle of the Catholic Church, it's called the just war theory.
Correct.
But it takes four provisions to really make that happen. And I would just like to give some assurance to Catholics that we're not warmongers as Catholics. Matter of fact, we're to do everything we can to avoid war.
Absolutely.
But there is circumstances in which we do have a right to defend ourselves.
Oh, well, absolutely. I think if you look at the just war tradition, it places limits on war. Mm-hmm. So what you have in the tradition is you have, for example, certain conditions that must be met before one can engage in war.
Before we go any further, let me do the – I'm just giving the doctrine on just war so people can hear, and then we can talk about them.
Okay,
and,
sure.
And the four principles are this. The damage inflicted by the aggressor on the nation or community of nations must be lasting, grave, and certain. The second one is all other means of putting an end to it must have shown to be impractical or ineffective. The third one is there must be serious prospects of success. Mm-hmm. And the fourth one is the use of arms must not produce evil or disorders graver than the evil to be eliminated. The power of modern means of destruction weigh very heavily in eliminating this condition. So those are the four principles.
And actually, there's a different list.
Yes.
When I was a student, in my Catholic socioethics courses, we had seven principles. And
okay.
Then if you look at what the bishops say in the Challenge of Peace, they added to that. They added a condition called comparative justice.
Okay. Yes.
Which means that it recognized that maybe there is some justice on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
But the side that has the greater justice is entitled to to limit violence by engaging in some form of justified force.
Okay.
All right. So I'm going to be careful in my language there.
Okay.
But the concern is not to confuse the principles jus ad bellum, the right to go to war, with the principles of jus in bello, which are what one needs to do during the course of the war to keep it just.
Okay.
Interesting enough, the bishops in their 1983 document, and I know this document very well because I wrote on it.
Okay.
But in their 1983 document actually even mentioned proportionality, which you're referring to.
Yes.
Greater damage should not occur.
Exactly.
As one of the conditions before the war.
Right.
But it's also as a condition during the course of the war. For example, my own dissertation advisor, Jim Hannigan, was during the Vietnam conflict, was a professor at Marquette. And Hannigan claimed in an article he wrote in Chicago Studies, I remember well, that whatever the reason was the United States may have entered into the Vietnam conflict, proportionality made that conflict really problematic.
Okay.
That the damage that was being done was much too extensive to sustain a justified force in Vietnam.
Okay.
So in other words, I think so. There and more recently now, there's talk about, and you see this in the writings of some experts on this. I think about Drew Christensen, the Jesuit, and others. There's been a recognition of what they call post-bellum conditions.
Okay.
In other words, once you leave a place, there must be some movement towards some kind of restoring.
Exactly.
Some kind of restoration of conditions that would make peace flourish.
Yes.
So I think there's been some development in that theory. There's some great stuff done on how, particularly recently, and you see this in the writings of John Paul II, and others that there's been some development in theory. And I think we're now at an age, and we're in an age in which the questions are not so much possible nuclear war.
Exactly.
Like in 1983, that was the issue.
Yes.
Clearly.
I mean, exactly.
Other, so the document of the bishops was particularly on nuclear weapons. Now we're in an age in which we have situations of genocide. For example, you mentioned this with ISIS and in Iraq. You have, and when what is the obligation then to deal with some force and military force in areas in which people are being killed?
Yeah,
and we see this. We've seen a real shift of this. There certainly has been one of my areas of interest is genocide. And you look at our policy in Rwanda, which I disagreed with.
Yeah.
I mean, I think we should have been more forceful there, and the United Nations have been more
How
forceful.
How many people were slaughtered there?
Yeah, hundreds of thousands.
Yes, yeah.
The numbers, I mean, hundreds of thousands of people were killed in Rwanda.
Yeah.
And part of it is America was smarting from Black Hawk down. Other words, and we didn't want American boys.
Another incident going on.
That's it. And in other words, you know, you bring the Belgian peacekeepers home and the whole issue. So it's a very complicated issue. And you're right, Deacon Jim, that it's very clear one ought not to relish in war.
That's right.
War is violence is what we would call an ontic evil.
Yeah.
It is not a good in and of itself.
It is.
But like other things in the church tradition, like private property, it's recognized as a condition that we live in.
Yeah.
And limited violence under control, mm-hmm. to stop aggression is not morally wrong.
Yeah, that's right. You know, I dug up something too, because there's a dichotomy of thinking. Sometimes people think in the Bible, in the Beatitudes, Jesus tells us, "Blessed are the peacemakers," and elsewhere in the Sermon on the Mount, he says, "If one strikes you on the right cheek, turn
right.
the other
yes.
also." But then, conversely, we see in Luke 22:36. At the same time, Jesus acknowledges the legitimate use of force, telling his apostles, "Let him who has no sword sell his mantle and buy one." And he was talking about the understanding that down the road you're going to have to defend yourself. And it doesn't necessarily mean it was going to be with violence, but there is an understanding that we do have an obligation in this world, particularly if there's something like we see in Rwanda going on. We need to help people.
There's an obligation to help people. I mean, the text aside, and if you look at the question became up very early on in the church, by the way, for the first 300 years or so, whether or not Christians could serve in the military.
Yes, I remember.
Actually,
that.
Until about 185 A.D., there is no evidence that they did. There's some thought that they may have. But after 185, they begin to see that there were tombstones that recognized people as Christians. So when the archaeological evidence suggested they did. But from the period up until the 4th century, up until Christianity is tolerated and finally becomes the official religion of the Roman Empire, during that entire period, there is a chorus of protests against service. Now, the reasons vary. So, in other words, people would argue and say, then we fell from grace with Constantine. I don't think so. I think the reasons why Christians did not serve in the military was for a lot of reasons. One is that the lifestyle of people in the military.
Right.
Duh. You know, you keep the women and children off the streets.
So, right.
All right. The other close the bars. The other thing is emperor worship. So there are a lot of factors. It's a much more complex and complicated issue than we understand.
Exactly.
Oftentimes, I think we can shoot from the hip and say this and that, but I think it's much more complicated than we.
I understand it. And it wasn't it Augustine who first started the just war theory, who started writing that.
Augustine,
400 and something. Is that
yeah, that's, Augustine dies in 430. I'm correct. Yeah,
right.
I think 430.
Yeah.
All right. It was in 356. I forget. But in any event, Augustine takes up. He adds to what was said by Ambrose and also what you find in the classical pagan tradition and develops a theory of just war.
Okay.
What's interesting about Augustine is that Augustine's recognition of human sinfulness was dominant even in that.
Profound.
So he would not allow individual self-defense.
That's right.
But he said that one could serve the state because one would do so maybe purified of one's rancor, anger, hatred.
Yep.
Now the question is that possible? I mean that's a difficult thing.
You look at
the recent death of Robin Williams, and you know, Good Morning Vietnam. Is it possible?
Yeah.
Is it possible that people can be somehow purified of that as one inflicts death?
Or is that realistic in a fallen world to even think?
Yeah, it's and those who criticize, and I think they're onto something. I see this among some Protestant theologians, for example, would criticize the possibility of just war. I think when they say, can we keep our intention pure? I think it's pretty tough.
Yeah.
Notice that the church, in theory, allows, but in practice condemns capital punishment.
Exactly.
But nobody who the perpetrator, I don't want to use the word perpetrator, it's too strong a word. But the office of those who do capital punishment is not the family of one whose child or parent or brother or sister was a victim of someone's murder.
Sure.
But it's the state as a neutral agent that's supposed to do this impartially and fairly and without rancor. Yeah. Now that again, it's easier said than done. But
well, let me ask you this question. Then we're talking about this war and this theory of defending yourself or one not defending himself. I'm thinking of the Christians right now who are fleeing up in the mountains from the group called ISIS.
Yeah,
the church would definitely say they have a right to defend themselves.
Oh, everybody has a right to defend themselves.
So I guess my question is to you, Doctor, is when is it justifiable for us, if at all, to become part of that defense of those people? At what point? I mean, I think this is the line we have to draw somewhere and have to have an understanding of when do we as a country say, you know, we didn't do it in Rwanda. I mean, is there a number or is there a theory that has to go behind it or a principle we're going to stand on?
I think there ought to be. I don't know how you work that out in the practical world. I mean,
right.
In other words, I don't know if you've seen, but it actually is very well done. The PBS presentation, The Ghost of Rwanda.
I did
but
not
you see the testimonies of how we were going back and forth on this, and it's very, very well. It's certainly worthwhile. I show clips of that in my Catholic social ethics class for students. But it's I think those are prudential judgments.
Okay.
But I think in present situation, I think certainly in the situation in eastern Ukraine, and this is a case that's dear to me, having taught there and. Places like that, I think we have to not necessarily get militarily involved, but I think we have to make a strong statement when evil is being perpetrated on people.
And you know, you brought up the Ukraine again. We're in another situation there where we're seeing a lot of people dying, an understanding of evil being it's being perpetrated on the people there. Where do we draw the line on that? Where do we become part of that? I mean, as Catholics and as Christians, and how do we justify that? Again, we're talking about this just war again, and how we live within our own moral conscience with that.
I hear what you're saying.
Yeah.
I hear your concern. I mean, I think for some of us, I think would say very clearly that what we need is as many sanctions as possible. I think bullies need to be stopped.
Yeah,
simple as that. I mean, in other words, the first thing is to stop any bully.
And first, the question would be, how do we do that? And,
yes, exactly.
And that becomes the logistics of it,
and how
we do it.
Exactly, Jake and Jim.
Yeah, I mean, so that becomes problematic for us as Catholics. Mm-hmm. I mean, for the country, for the world, it becomes problematic.
Sure.
Because there's too much war going on as it is. So, but we're in this now, and we're in a tumultuous time in our world, and you and I both agree to that. I know.
Oh yeah, a friend of mine is a Ukrainian priest. I picked him up in Dearborn last week, a week before. Father Ola, he actually served with me when I was a Fulbright in Ukraine, and then he came to Aquinas as a Fulbright to work with our sustainability program.
Let people understand what you mean by a Fulbright.
It's a government program, government sponsored program it's a cultural exchange of scholars.
Okay. And I only ask that of you because sometimes we throw these words around and people go, I have no idea what he's talking about that.
But my friend Ola and I met in Dearborn, and then we
visited my son in Royal Oak and Detroit, and spent some time at a monastery in Warren, a Basilian monastery. But we were talking about this, and I said, Ola, coming back, because you stayed with us in Grand Rapids, I said, you know, it's amazing to me that what seems like the situation has never been as bad as it is. And maybe I'm seeing that, or maybe it's the social media that does it. But the world situations are much worse than I can ever remember.
Yeah, and you and me both. And, you know, you're only a few years older than me. So we're both watching a time that I never imagined in my lifetime. And the understanding is we're fighting different types of ideologies and thinking. We're not just fighting people who are trying to get along. It's really such a difference in thinking in so many different of these worlds. Take Korea, for example. I mean, North Korea and South Korea have a totally different understanding of what they're asking for and what they're looking for. Yet, it's the dictators that are causing the problem.
Yeah, and our Pope there is there today.
I know.
Today, it's airing, yes.
You know, and while he was there, I see three missiles were actually test-fired from North Korea. Probably trying to throw the fear of God in our Pope Francis, but
No. He has an awesome fear of God in the best sense.
Amen.
Yeah, he's.
Yeah, but that's the understanding I'm trying to get. How do we overcome this difference in philosophy and in thinking? Particularly, you know, we're fighting a war against. If we fight against the Muslims, we're having two different trains of thoughts there, and how do you these two worlds are colliding right now?
Yeah, that is, and that's why I think people from within that tradition, and I think recently there has been, is to condemn ISIS and their beheading of Christians.
Yeah.
And their murderous acts. I mean, you need people within the tradition to condemn.
Yes.
Rather than someone on the outside.
Exactly.
I think we should have been much more forceful, not necessarily military aid. I'm not arguing that. Much more forceful when Christians were being displaced, for example, in Mosul and places like that. I mean, we allowed. I recently was at a conference in Chicago with Eastern Catholic churches, Chaldeans and Syrians and people like that. As well as some of the Slavic churches. But one of the things that struck me is, I mean, you know, their real fear of how difficult it now is to live in the Middle East.
Yes.
Here is the cradle of Christianity.
Yes.
Christianity does not come out of Ireland, Poland, right, what we think about Italy. Huh? Christianity comes out of the Middle East, right?
Amen.
It's a Middle Eastern tradition.
Yes.
And yet in those areas in which the Christian populations have been decimated.
As you said, it's the first time in 1,500 years in Mosul.
Yeah, we talked about this before. Yes, yeah, exactly.
No mass. That's what it's decimated, that whole Christian community over there. But, you know, Doctor, I think one of the realities, too, is this, and we're saying, why is the condemnation doesn't come out of other communities? You know, we as Catholics have the privilege and the ability, even if we don't agree with our church, we can speak without fear of repercussions as a free voice. In other traditions, in some traditions, particularly in some of the Middle Eastern traditions, you could fear for your life in speaking against it. And so I think many times it might hold those communities against speaking against the evil that's going on.
Interesting. I'm not privy to that, but you know, it's something to consider. I think what you're saying is something to consider.
Yeah.
Never thought in those terms of why people are silent.
Yeah, and I just have.
But I think that's an interesting insight.
Yeah, I think there could be a real fear in that. Even in this country, I think the reprisal can easily cross the waters, and I think you find some tepidness in that.
Yeah.
And we need them to have them speak out, and that's going to be part of it. But let's get back to what we really you have a heart for. Also, you know, when I talk to my Catholic brothers and sisters, Roman Catholic brothers and sisters, there's a real misunderstanding of Roman Catholic, Eastern Rite Catholic, Eastern Rite Orthodox, and all that. You know, we need to get some clarity on that. And I know you're the guy that can bring that to us. So let's kind of digest that and give us the clarity on that. Would you please?
All right. Okay. Christianity is a Middle Eastern phenomenon, right, as I said. So Christianity rises in Jerusalem, right?
Right.
It spreads. It spreads to Antioch in Syria. It spreads to Egypt. It spreads to Italy, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
So all of these are churches that are in communion with each other. All right. So it's not like it's centered in one place.
But they're still under one authority.
they're under authority of Jesus Christ.
Right.
Yes. The authority is Jesus Christ.
Exactly.
Right. Okay. So then we'll get to the point about the Pope.
Okay.
Don't worry. All right. Okay. So what happens is Christianity develops. And the church is all in communion with each other. Mm-hmm. Rome is given a preeminence. There's no question about it. All right. Okay. And the way Rome exercised that preeminence in the first millennium, as John Paul II says, and Benedict has said, and others have said, need not be the way it functioned in the second millennium, which was much more jurisdictional and juridical. But be that as it may, I'm not going to get into that issue.
Okay.
So Christianity is this, and so it isn't until but early on there are splits within these communions.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, in 431, at the Council of Ephesus, there's a debate about it's really a Christological debate, but it issues in the condemnation of some of the name of Nestorius. All right. Well, the followers of Nestorius later on move to and receive some support in parts of the Persian world, and they became what is known as the Assyrian Church of the East.
Okay.
It's a legitimate church. It's actually Rome and the Assyrian Church of the East and the Eastern Catholic counterpart, the Chaldeans, agreed on in situations where it is prudent and there is only one faith community that this early group, which separated from communion, can, along with Chaldean Catholics, share the same Eucharist.
Okay.
That's another issue. It's a very interesting issue, but
right.
I think it's very significant. But and then 451, there's other splits. So other Christians over the Christological issue of the Council of Chalcedon split. So that group would include Copts
the
Christians in Egypt,
mm-hmm.
Syrians, Syrian Christians. And others, Armenians, many of them split over that Christological controversy. So you have two splits in the first millennium very early on. Then in 1054, we have another split between Rome and Constantinople.
Mm-hmm.
There were certainly some attempts of reunion at the Council of Lyons and also at Florence in the second millennium, but that generally didn't work out. So what happens is that certain Eastern Christians, hierarchs, and in some cases patriarchs, came into full communion with Rome on a individual basis. So what we have out there are several different groups. We have what you would call this Assyrian Church of the East.
Okay.
All right. Then you have the Chalcedonian, we'd call non-Chalcedonian Christians. Sometimes they're called Oriental Orthodox.
Okay.
And then you have what you call the Eastern Orthodox, which is the largest group. These are like your mom, huh?
Right.
The Greeks, all right. You got the Russians.
Hard-headed Greek Orthodox.
No comment. I'm going to the festival at the end of this month. All right. I'll be there, too. Good. All right. but in any event, you have these groups that are now split. Some groups that we call Eastern churches never split from Rome.
Okay.
One such group are the Maronites in Lebanon. They came from an area in the northern part of Lebanon. They were separated from communion because of Islam.
Right.
Right. History repeats itself. So they were separated because of Islam. There's another group called the Italo-Albanian group.
You know, I just want to draw attention to what you just said because it's very important for people to hear about history repeating itself because we're living through that again in some of these areas with Islam.
I think what we're living through is a situation in which the Middle Eastern churches, the heart of Christendom,
exactly
in the beginning. I don't want to use the Christendom as a more medieval term, but the heart of Christianity in terms of lands and mm-hmm. peoples are under duress.
Yep.
In any event, there are some groups that didn't split, but eventually what happened were some of these groups, as I mentioned, came back into full communion with Rome. So Rome can so the Catholic Church then consists of the majority that are Roman Catholic, 97-98%.
Right.
Plus, and it depends upon how you number them, 20 to 22 other Catholic churches in communion with Rome.
Rome.
They are Catholic churches, fully Catholic, most of which came out of the Orthodox traditions, mm-hmm. which initially came out of a tradition of communion that already existed in the first millennium, okay. right?
Right.
So churches were in communion with each other. And some of whom came out of the what you call the Oriental churches, Oriental Orthodox churches,
right.
the 451 split group. But these all came into full communion with Rome. So if you want to get a kind of a scorecard on it, the one church I'm most familiar with and I've worked with and I also attend, along with the Roman Catholic Church, is the Ukrainian Greek Catholic Church,
okay.
which comes into full communion again in 1596
okay.
at the Union of Brest. So there probably are political reasons. There certainly are political reasons. Am I kidding? But there are political reasons. There are also religious reasons. There are hierarchical conflict reasons where these churches now come into full communion. So the Eastern Catholic churches are in communion with each other and a communion with the See of Peter, right?
Okay, right.
And as well as the Roman Church is in communion. So in other words, that's the major part. It's interesting that our present Pope was actually mentored by a Ukrainian or an Eastern Catholic priest.
Is that right?
When he was in Rome. And the present Patriarch, Metropolitan Major Archbishop of Kiev, Halychyna, Svetoslav, served with Francis when he was the bishop in Argentina, the Ukrainian bishop in Argentina.
I want to clarify terminology, too, because I think it confuses people. You know, in the Orthodox Church, they'll call them patriarchs.
Some of them will.
Yeah. But the patriarch is really equivalent to a bishop, correct?
No, they're higher than a bishop, yeah.
They're higher than the bishop in that respect, but you're either a bishop or you become the pope in the Catholic
Church. No, the Catholic Church, the pope is a bishop.
Right, but he's a bishop of Rome.
He's a bishop, that's what he is. He's a bishop.
Bishop.
Benedict actually got rid of the title patriarch of the West, which caused some problems with the East, but nonetheless.
That's why I'm having you here to clarify
In other words, the Francis is the pope because he's the successor of Peter
right.
and he is the bishop of Rome,
bishop,
as you say.
Exactly.
But he's a bishop. There's no – I gave you this when you're a student. It's not one of these pyramid things. You got the pope at the top and then cardinals and archbishop,
right.
blah, blah, blah. That's not the way it is basically a circular view where you have an order of bishops,
okay.
an order of catechumens, an order of laity, an order of presbyters, an order of deacons, and we're all in this church together. We're a communion, right?
Right.
And so patriarchs were key elements, and therefore in the Eastern churches, several of the churches have actually patriarchs,
okay.
as you know, Jim. You know, the Armenians have a patriarch.
Yes,
the Syrians have a patriarch. The Melkites have a patriarch. The Maronites have a patriarch. The Ukrainians claim to have a patriarch, but Rome hasn't officially designated that, although in liturgy, the Ukrainians refer to Svetoslav Sevchuk as patriarch.
Okay. But let me make a clarification so people understand that, and myself.
Yeah.
And I understand different churches have different patriarchs. But their position is really in a leadership, correct? I mean, when they have patriarch in their churches, that patriarch has authority over the people of his...
Of his church,
yes.
Absolutely.
Yes.
And actually what happens is when a new patriarch is elected, and it depends upon... That's why patriarchal status is higher status than metropolitan archbishop
okay.
or major archbishop. What happens is this. The people in that particular church elect their patriarch.
Okay.
How that's elected varies. Actually, sometime in some of the churches, the laity were involved in the election of their bishops. It's very interesting. It's a very different system than we have in the West. I think electing bishops could be too political, quite candidly. I'm
sure.
Generally against the Westerns. We hate each other now. It'd be worse. All right. I wouldn't want to go there. But nonetheless, I think you have a system, and therefore, what happens is when a patriarch is elected by the church, then the church sends a letter.
Okay.
Like the Melkites do, they have a new patriarch, sends a letter to the Bishop of Rome and says we want to be in communion with the Catholic Church. So I think oftentimes Eastern churches are seen as a third way. Sometimes they're seen as a very negative way, as a, you know, kind of they're called pejoratively uniates. I see them more as a bridge between East and West.
Okay.
That's my bias.
Okay.
And I value them, and I think they have the richness. They have the richness of the Orthodox traditions, of their own traditions. So they're church. They have rites, and we sometimes call them rites. They have rites or ways of doing things. They have a theological tradition, you know, that's based in a certain area, and different churches share certain rites.
Right.
So the Arab Malkite and the Ukrainians share a Byzantine rite or way of doing liturgy. All right. So they have rites. But they really are, in many ways, a church. They are a church in communion with each other. And they come out of a particular culture, a particular ethnicity in many cases.
Okay.
That's one problem with some of this is that unlike the Western Roman Church, they can be more ethnocentric.
Yes, they can.
Which can be problematic. I mean, I realize this. Sometimes, you know, obviously the Roman Catholic Church is, you know, it's Polish, it's German, it's Irish, you know, it's Italian, it's French, blah blah blah. Mm-hmm. But the universality, in a certain sense, I think is a real strength. And I think the value of Eastern churches being in communion with Rome is there's a certain sense that we're in this together.
Exactly.
Universality stress. And I think that's a very important.
Yeah.
I think that's very important.
And you are drawn particularly. Now, and let me, if I can get my history correct, didn't Stalin, during the 1900s, force the Ukrainians to become Russian?
Absolutely. 1946. There was what we call the pseudo Synod of Lviv.
Yeah.
In 1946, the Ukrainian Greek Catholic Church was repressed. There was a meeting at St. Yuri's Cathedral in Lviv, and it was attended by some priest. And it was there were some priests that were kind of sponsored, but no Ukrainian hierarch. Not one bishop is present. In order to be a church, you got to have a bishop.
Exactly.
Notice my numbers there. It's 20 to 22, depending upon whether you have a bishop.
Yeah.
The Eastern churches, there are. You have to have a bishop. No Ukrainian Catholic bishop was present. None were present. You know.
Was that by choice,
by the Soviet choice. Of course it was.
Yeah.
And then what happened is they then dissolved the Ukrainian Greek Catholic Church, and it wasn't until before the breakdown of the Soviet Union, 1989, that the church was then legalized in Ukraine. So the Greek Catholic Church was legalized. But sometimes it has history of repression,
yeah.
History of priests and their wives and children being sent to Siberia. Now, in the Eastern churches, you know, the custom in many of the Eastern churches, particularly the Slavic churches, for a married clergy as well as monastic clergy.
Did much of that go underground?
Oh, church went way underground.
Yeah.
So in other words, I got slides that I use with some of my work in showing, you know, for example, that liturgy was being celebrated in apartments.
Yeah.
In forest, you have a priest hearing confessions in a forest in the woods. You see, later in the 1980s. During Perestroika and Glasnost, you see people actually having liturgy and praying in front of closed Greek Catholic churches.
Oh my goodness!
I mean, the churches. I am moved by my experience there. I mean, I remember going to St. Yuri's Cathedral, and I went to the crypt, and the crypt of that church is where the confessors and martyrs of the church laid, the hierarchs.
Yeah, amazing.
And I remember I was with a guy who would, you know, this guy was more into Hrilko or vodka than religion. this is my driver. He was a friend who was a cousin of one of the people from Grand Rapids who took me around later after the after I finished working there. And it was interesting to see this guy. Here's a man, you know, tough guy, you know, never went to church, mm-hmm. you know, and crying as he saw these men. Outside the very house that I lived at when I was a Fulbright scholar in 2008, there was a father, Andrew Ishchuk, who was shot right within less than a kilometer.
Oh my goodness.
Maybe a half kilometer from where I was, or a quarter of a kilometer from the house in which I lived. Because there was a railroad station there. So when what happened in 1941 is when Germany attacks Russia, the Russians already took over east of western Ukraine.
Yes,
because there was the agreement, Soviet German agreement, and then the Germans came into Lviv, and the church again was persecuted and torn. It's a very heroic church. It's a church of witnesses.
Yes.
Francis makes a very important point, I think, when he suggests that, you know, there are more martyrs in the 20th century than there ever were in the early church. He's right.
Exactly.
And you see this particularly in Ukraine. You find this in Romania. Oftentimes, some churches, fellow Christians, got in bed with politicians
Absolutely.
And suppressed the church.
Absolutely.
I mean, Robert Royal's book on Catholic martyrs of the 20th century is a very good introduction to some of what has happened in particularly in Eastern Europe and other places.
I think of Karol Wojtyla going underground in Poland, all the martyrs that were going through there at the time. And he was an underground seminarian at the time.
Exactly.
And exactly what you're talking about in Ukraine. They probably had underground seminaries going on there also.
Well, they went to Rome. And what they did, what was really smart is this, is here, the Ukrainians are incredibly resilient. I just love them. But here's what they did. They kept a hierarch. So in other words, they always had a hierarch. When Patriarch Joseph Slippy was removed during Vatican II, the Soviets released Patriarch Joseph from prison. But he went to a cave and went to a hotel room or something else. But then some people visited him. What he did was he ordained a bishop. Right? In other words, reordained a bishop. So in other words, when there was a real concern that you would have underground bishops. There certainly were underground priests.
Of course.
My friend Ola, his grandfather was a priest, the one I just mentioned in passing. His grandfather was a priest, and his grandfather wound up in Siberia.
My goodness.
So it is not uncommon to have seen, becoming bishop is not one-upsmanship.
Exactly.
It's not a career move. The bishop is the next one to go. You got it? In other words, this is the guy. He's on exactly it. And yeah. I think there was something that was – so you accepted that, not this – this is not power and glory, right?
Right.
This basically is martyrdom.
You would know taking that position – that you would be a bullseye also.
Absolutely.
That was something, Jim, that you received from the Spirit of God, and that you couldn't say no to the Lord. So you take that position.
Exactly. Exactly. That's expressed very well. I think expressed very well.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You knew that.
Yeah. This is Deacon Jim Thorndale. You listen to Holy Family Radio, and I'm here with Dr. Robert Marco, the head of the Aquinas College Theology Department, and we're talking today about just war. We're talking about the Eastern Rite churches and the Ukrainian church, and soon we're going to have a little conversation with our beloved Pope, Pope Francis here, but we're talking about the struggles with the Ukrainians right now and the Catholic Church over there, and continue on, Doctor.
We could talk about that. One of the things that Soviet propaganda suggested is that that Euromaidan was basically put up by certainly the West, but also by the Ukrainian Catholic clergy. The Ukrainian Catholic clergy were very present in this moment.
Yeah.
The priests were there.
Yeah.
The priests were there at the people. One of the characteristics and the people remember this, and I know this from living there and going back there and from students, is that the clergy were always with the people.
Amen.
And they were there. They were there in Kyiv, we call Kyiv in the West. They were there. They were there with the protesters. They're ministering to them. They have a strong presence with the people.
Exactly.
And the people do not forget that. And so therefore, the revival of the church after 1989, when the church grew and grows and grows and grows, and they developed their own university.
That's right.
So another from a theological college, the Ukrainian Catholic University is the only Eastern Catholic university in the world, huh?
Yeah. You know, I find it ironic. We're talking about the priests are always with their people, and here we are talking on the feast of Maximilian Kolbe.
Yes, a great man.
Who was a Franciscan who was with his people at the very end and gave his life for a young husband and father.
Incredible man.
Yeah.
My kid, when I was in Ukraine in 2008, one of my sons was in Salamanca, so he came to visit me, and we went to Krakow, and then we went to Auschwitz, and I remember Josh and I going in and seeing the it was the decorated his cell was decorated
oh.
But and John Paul II, of course, was there.
Yeah, praise be to God.
I mean, you could see that, and it was a profound experience. And I knelt down outside that cell to say, "This is a man who," and he didn't die. As you know the story. He didn't die. They tried to starve him, and he died.
That's right.
They finally had to inject him.
3 or 4 weeks
they tried to starve him, and he didn't die. Drove them nuts.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing. But
you see the church. You see the church, and it's best.
Yeah. Well, and another thing, Dr. Marco, and I may sound simplistic, but we know that Jesus said, "I will never leave you or forsake you."
Oh, absolutely.
And if we draw back on that, even regardless of what's going on in this world, He's never going to leave us or forsake us. The church will maintain. We may be a remnant, but you know what? I'm going to be part of that remnant by the grace of God.
And Francis, I think, if we get into that eventually, maybe next week when we continue. No, I'd be joking. We both talk too much. But as we always have, if I remember correctly. In any event, you want to be as bringing in as many as you can to the good news of the gospel.
Yeah.
And we're not. The gates of hell will not. Will not.
What do you see right now today? And you know what? You made a good point. I would love to have you back, really, to talk about Francis, because we can't do him justice in 8 minutes. And I think we can. You and I could have a great conversation about our Pope that we both love. I want to continue on with this. What do you see for the future of the Ukrainian Church right now, as it goes right now? How much? What are they going to go through? What do you think?
Well, I mean, I there are areas within Ukraine where, under Soviet domination, you were not allowed to have Ukrainian Greek Catholic parishes. I remember I was in Sumy, which is on the Russian border. Sumy is in eastern Ukraine.
I don't mean to interrupt you, but I do, because it's ironic. I see in the news today that Cuba is going to put up the first Catholic church in many years, and they're using the steel that was used for when the Pope was there. They're going to use the same steel structure to build this Catholic church.
Neat.
It's so bizarre in how the church works. And I'm thinking about Ukraine right now and continue on.
When I was in Sumy, they, for example, I had a young friend who's now a Jesuit in Poland, in Krakow, Vladimir, a young friend of Vladimir, and I visited his family there and spent some time there, and in the parish he was at, it was a Polish Roman Catholic parish.
Okay,
in the city, but the Ukrainians, Greek Catholics, were allowed to use the facilities for divine liturgy in the afternoon on Sundays. But the presence of the Ukrainian church, which was a concern of certainly Patriarch Svetoslav and the whole church.
I'm going to stop you just a minute, because you made another point I want to clarify to people. In the Western, in the Roman Catholic Church, we call it the Mass. And yet in the Orthodox or Eastern Rite, it's called liturgy or divine liturgy.
Exactly.
So I just want to clarify to people that we're talking really about the Mass or the divine liturgy.
We're talking about the divine
liturgy. Eucharist.
Yeah. Ukrainians sometimes use the word Mass because they realize that Westerners are so dumb. That's true. And they know Westerners know absolutely nothing about the Eastern churches.
Yeah.
I often joke to my students, to those who've read a book or so, I said, you probably know more than most hierarchs are in the West. But in any event, it is divine. It is divine liturgy. It's different in the way it's celebrated, but certainly it's the same reality.
Right. I mean, I went to divine liturgy with my mother at the Orthodox Church. That was called liturgy.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I know about that.
Yeah, you know that. That's good. That was probably a good experience. It gave you a sense of the mystical East. And I tell you, the iconography and all that stuff. Did you go to Holy Trinity? Is that where you?
Yes.
Okay, yeah.
Yep.
Beautiful church.
Yeah,
beautiful church.
Well, actually, it was downtown on Ransom when I used to go there with my mother. But then when it moved over on Lakeside Drive, I went there before she passed away, and that's where we had her. She was buried out of that. But it's a beautiful church. The iconography, we had a lot of icons in my home. And, you really learn the rich and the rich tradition of the Orthodoxy in that too. It always overwhelmed me.
The icons are very moving. I actually prefer them to much Western art. Although some Western stuff can be done well.
Yeah.
But some is just gaudy, ugly. You may have to cut that.
I have to tell you, when I was in Rome, I saw some beautiful statues that took my breath away.
Yeah.
That was just absolutely stunning to see.
There is beauty. There is beauty in the West.
Yeah.
There is. And there certainly is beauty in the East.
Yeah, of course.
There's certainly beauty in there's beauty in both traditions.
Yes.
No question.
Yeah. So you're still part of the Roman Catholic Church, and obviously you go to the Ukrainian Church also. And I'm not going to ask you your preference because, you know, I know we could, that'd be another hour and why we want to do that. But now, which church, which is Ukrainian here in our
St. Michael's on Gold.
Okay.
Gold and Sibley.
Okay.
Small community, many older people.
Okay.
Many immigrants are part of what they call the Ukraine diaspora.
Okay.
People that came from Poland and parts of Ukraine over the years. So it's a much older community. Okay. There's something about the I call the people there, and certainly they're like all of us. We're all wounded sinners in many ways, but
amen.
They're living icons.
Yeah.
I mean, for me. So in other words, that's one of the appeals I have is the people, and the priest is just a good man, and
exactly.
Same thing. I mean, there's a certain humility, simplicity, and a real concern for the poor. You find this real concern for the poor.
Yeah. Well, and you know, that really goes. I'm only speaking for myself, but we in this Western culture who really don't know poverty. Have a hard time understanding the depth and the scope of real poverty. You go to a third world country, or you go to Ukraine.
Exactly. I mean, you don't indoor plumbing,
right?
We don't know. I mean, I remember that my first time there was 2007. I volunteered to teach an English summer school, and we were at an orphanage, Ukrainian orphanage, and we didn't have running water or whatever. I mean, and then they had some water from a well, and then the commodes, got filled up within a day or so, and they couldn't flush. We're very much unaware, and we waste. My kids, I remember my kids, wasting water in the shower, and they come back and say, "For God's sake, please." Yeah.
We have no
for
idea
sake
about
of
that.
The Lord. I mean, people do not have water. I mean, that struck me.
You know, one of the courses in every college should be that every student has to go to a third world country and spend some time and understand what they're privileged to have. We don't do that.
No, we're spoiled.
Yeah,
we're spoiled. My kids say they're not spoiled. They're privileged. I don't say they're spoiled. But
yeah,
we're privileged. Privileged at least.
But with privileges come responsibility.
Yeah, we do. We have responsibility.
And that responsibility is to really understand how the rest of the world lives.
Exactly.
And we have a hard time with that because it's too messy.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, it's just part of who we are. But unfortunately, we are slowly running out of time, and it's been a pleasure to have you here. Now, I'm going to entice you because I've enjoyed this conversation. You brought your book on Pope Francis, A Big Heart Open to God. And we have a lot of exploration to do about our new pope, and I know you have a lot to say about him.
Oh, I certainly I find him incredibly refreshing. I think he is a bridge builder.
Yeah.
I think the church is polarized.
Yeah.
I think it's tragic.
Yes.
I think it's tragic. I think we call each other names, and there's a real
right.
tension there. When I was just in Pittsburgh a week ago, I met a young Italian. Well, not young. He's older than I actually now. But I remember him as a kid.
Young.
I remember as a kid. Yeah, I remember as a kid. You know, in other words, he hasn't practiced faith for years, and his wife was raised in a mainline Protestant tradition. But I remember the reaction to Francis. So people to whom the church has had no interest are partly interested because of Francis, because he witnesses the gospel.
Yes, and he lives
humility.
The gospel.
He lives the gospel.
Yeah,
he lives the gospel. It's not a matter, it's not a ploy.
Yep.
To look at me kissing a disfigured man or a palsy child, it is authentic.
Yep.
And I think people see that and people know it.
Yep.
And people, as we share in the same spirit of God, recognize the authenticity of that.
You know, in God's providence, too, he knew for all time we needed this man at this time in our church to really be a bridge builder, as you said. So we thank God for him here. Doctor, I want to thank you for being here. Unfortunately, we're running out of time, but I'm going to warmly invite you back again so we can have another conversation, because this has been enlightening for me and I'm sure for the people who are listening. And I want to thank all the listeners here at Holy Family Radio for joining myself and Dr. Markle. I wish you all a beautiful day, and may God bless. Thank you for listening.
Thank you,
thank you,
Jim.
Been listening to Living the Catholic Life with your host Deacon Jim Thorndale on Holy Family Radio. If you'd like to listen to this program again or share it with a friend, audio copies are available online at holyfamilyradio.net. Thank you for listening.